you going to do now, Bob? License to Kill. License to Kill. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Dylan.
Hello out there, my friends. This is Binal, binalofamerica.com, the third installment of Binal of America Audio. I want to welcome you to this week's big show. First of all, big thanks to everybody out there who's been listening and checking out the MP3s. Much appreciated. Getting lots of great feedback. I hope you enjoy. We've redesigned the website, binalofamerica.com, so I hope you check that out. Maybe by the time you're listening to this, it's already all up and running. And that's it. Let's rock and roll. This week we've got Alfred Weber. Now, before I went down to X Conference, I really had no idea who Alfred Weber was. I hadn't really heard his name in any of the many UFO books I read. And I believe he only made one appearance on the Jeff Rentz show a handful of days before he came down to Washington. So he was a relative unknown, for me at least, going into the conference. But he was billed as the father of exopolitics, and I'm a big fan of exopolitics, so he was definitely someone I was interested in meeting. And I was very lucky because at the Saturday night dinner, one of the great things about the X conference is that they place each of the speakers at different tables, so the people that go have the opportunity to at least sit at the table with one of the speakers, and in my case, chat with the speaker. I sat next to Alfred Weber, and we talked for 2 or 3 hours about everything under the sun. It was an amazing conversation. It was one of those times where time stands still. So I knew after that, I was like, I have got to talk to this guy. I've got to get an interview. I've got to bring it to the masses at binalofamerica.com. They have to hear him. So that's what I did. Now a little bit for those of you who don't know about Alfred Weber. Alfred Weber was a Fulbright scholar, and he holds degrees from Yale University, Yale Law School. He was the Yale Law School National Scholar and the University of Texas Counseling Program. He's taught economics at Yale University in the Economics Department, and civil liberties at the University of Texas in the Government Department. And he's been a futurist at Stanford Research Institute. He has been general counsel to the New York City Environmental Protection Administration. He was the environmental consultant to the Ford Foundation and a member of the government's Emergency Task Force on Earthquake Preparedness for the state of California. Alfred Weber produced and hosted The Instant of Cooperation, the first live radio broadcast between the United States of America and the Soviet Union. I believe he was honored by the United Nations for this amazing achievement. This interview was conducted on Sunday, April 24th, 2005, at the X Conference in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Tim Binal interviews Alfred Weber, the father of exopolitics.
How you doing, everybody? It's Tim Binal with binalofamerica.com, and I'm here with Alfred Weber, the father of exopolitics. You've heard him on Jeff Rentz, and I had the pleasure of sitting next to him last night to meet the speakers. No, it was the, what was it, the banquet.
Yeah, this was the banquet, and we had as our honored banquet guest, Monsignor Conraldo Balducci.
Yeah.
Who is the extraterrestrial theologian of Il Vaticano.
And, well, why don't you tell me about what you're talking about here today? I saw you earlier this morning. I saw your presentation. It was fantastic. And why don't you just give a little heads up to everybody at the website who didn't get a chance to check out the X Conference?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm very happy to do so. What we did And when I say we, it's on behalf of the Institute for Cooperation in Space. We're a nonprofit educational foundation, was to give an update to the X conference of our exopolitical initiative. And very briefly, it's been quite a year, and I think it's going to be a very active year, a very positive year, kind of a breakthrough year. In March of 2005, we were able to table with the Canadian Senate, the Committee on Security and National Defense, an exopolitical initiative, a Canadian exopolitical initiative, calling for what sort of taking the whole extraterrestrial issue outside of the military intelligence arena, where it's been stuck for 60 years, and placing it more under the Ministry of Education, in the education area and in the scientific area, where it really belongs, taking it out of the threat into the opportunity. And that was very well received by the Canadian Senate, particularly since we're operating under the authority of the United Nations General Assembly resolution. In 1978, the United Nations General Assembly approved a resolution calling upon all member states to initiate research and other programs about extraterrestrial life, and in fact authorized the formation of the United Nations office to deal exclusively with extraterrestrial light. So one of the senators even mentioned, gee, it's great that we have a United Nations resolution, because Canada is very committed to the United Nations. And so that was very good. What helped us also was that we went in the preamble, the Honorable Paul Hellyer, who had been Minister of Defense of Canada in 1967, he, while Minister of Defense, on June 3rd, 1967, flew out to St. Paul, Alberta, and officially inaugurated the world's first official extraterrestrial landing pad dedicated to intergalactic peace. So that's, you know, kind of an openness that has existed in Canadian society all of this time. And that's one step that we're going to be carrying forward. As Steve Bassett mentioned, today's Sunday, April 24th, 2005, and tomorrow, Monday, April 25th, 2005, the X conference and a number of us in the XO political community will be at the National Press Club holding a press conference. This will be a follow-up press conference to the disclosure press conference, which is held on May 9, 2001, with 20 or so high-level military intelligence whistleblowers disclosing and documenting the extraterrestrial presence on Earth. Well, one of the purposes of this press conference is to announce the exopolitical initiative in the U.S. context. An exopolitics platform, which is essentially, look, let's have a decade of contact, federally funded open education and research over a 10-year period, coupled with open, transparent public interest diplomacy with spiritually advanced off-planet cultures that are now visiting Earth. And we're going to be outreaching to political candidates across the spectrum, as well as to local city councils. And we have one group that will be going forward here. In the 2006 race, there's already a slate of congressional candidates that has agreed they are exopolitically friendly. And also in the 2008 race, because so much policy is determined here in the U.S. context by the presidential candidates and by who is the chief executive officer and sort of the commander-in-chief, that kind of context. That we'll be approaching on a nonpartisan basis on all the parties, the Democrat major party, the Republican, the Green parties, the Libertarians, with an objective exopolitical platform. You may recall that the last U.S. president to run on an open exopolitical platform was in 1976, Jimmy Carter, who in fact had a UFO encounter in 1969 while he was running for Governor of Georgia in the company of 10 members of the Larry Georgia Lions Club. Well, he posted that while governor of Georgia in 73, and he ran in 76 against the Warren Commission member, Gerald Ford. And he won. He won an exopolitics platform that says, yes, I'm going to open up the ET issue. Well, we know he was thwarted, but he won the election. So we're going to go forward to all the 2008 candidates. We understand that one particular candidate, Senator Hillary Clinton, we know it's documented that she has a longstanding interest in the exopolitical issues, and she's friendly toward them. She's met with her husband, with Lawrence Rockefeller and others in this area, trying to get to the bottom of it. And it's even as a senator, she has championed the cause of the exoarchaeologists searching, you know, the various photographs of possible artificial structures throughout the solar system. And she's forced NASA to release those photographs. So she's friendly and cognizant and has fought for exopolitical causes. So she would be an ideal candidate to have an exopolitical plank in her platform. So I think it's a very active time for people to become involved in these matters. We've opened up a whole new arena if you go up to exopolitics.com of where people can become involved. And from an exopolitical point of view, get involved at your local municipality. There's a resolution that you can bring to your local city council. You can bring it to your congressperson for the Congress. The platform that you can ask that either the congressperson, if they're running for re-election, or other candidates in the 2006 race, will that they do it. I think that, you know, there's sort of a signal being given out. The time is very short. We have the 2006, December 26, 2004 tsunami. Some of the best evidence indicates now that that may have been caused by galactic events, by an explosion of a neutron star, and signaling the start of a galactic superwave that periodically comes. So it's clear that we may well have to go into an exopolitical kind of interactive scenario where we leave behind the 20th century worldview that intelligent life ends at the geostationary orbit, and we move on to a more realistic and evolved view, and that is that the universe is populated, that it operates under universal law, that we have governance systems and politics, and that we're an entry-level planet, but that we're all moving as a whole, and that even the UFO phenomenon as a communication outreach over the last 60 years may have been sent out as just that, a communication outreach to bring up, you know, the threshold of awareness of our planet and of our population to get us ready for the environmental stress that may be coming our way. So I think that it's a signal to our aware audience here that the time is to, you know, become aware, stay aware, keep active, keep informed, and take whatever personal steps you think your kind of inner guidance leads you, whether it's to start talking to people or become involved or read more or, you know, that kind of a thing.
All right. Well, why don't you give me a little bit of your background? Because I know you worked with the Carter administration and then you ended up at SRI. And tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. The way that happened, I became involved in this field in the early 70s and developed what's called the theory, the context communication theory of extraterrestrial communication, which is published in the mid-70s, which holds that UFO encounters can be viewed as many things, including multidimensional communications, in the same way that dreams are communications via our subconscious to our conscious. So they're loaded with symbolism and kind of communications. Following that, Jimmy Carter, of course, was elected, and through various connections, I ended up at Stanford Research Institute as a futurist with the intention of approaching the Jimmy Carter White House to carry out one of the first scientific, open, transparent scientific studies taking the issue out of the military-industrial complex, putting it in the scientific context and in the educational context. I got approval at Stanford Research Institute, full approval. I reached out and found out the people in the Carter White House who were interested in the subject matter, met with them over the summer of 1977, got their preliminary approvals, brought on board some of the top scientists, began to outreach to the National Science Board, etc. What occurred then was that at a point in September, October 1977, I was called into a meeting at Stanford Research Institute, the Administrative Vice President, the liaison between SRI and the Pentagon, flew in for that meeting Peter Schwartz, who's now a fellow futurist of mine at the time and is now president of the Global Business Network, was at that meeting. And we were informed that if this study went forward, and this is almost verbatim, that the Pentagon would terminate all of its contracts with Stanford Research Institute. At the time, SRI's total budget was about $100 million. A conservative estimate, it was probably that about $25 million was in Pentagon in terms of studies, contracts, and things like that. And so, and the official reason given was, quote, there are no UFOs. So there I was sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, because SRI terminated at the administrative level, agreed with the liaison that they didn't want to risk the contracts, and the study was terminated. So we've been able to develop the concept over the years and to bring it back now in the full exopolitics model, which is a bridging model of how we get from how we interactively integrate our terrestrial society with universal society.
All right, and you were talking about the remote viewing and the Martians and the integration of the Martians and the Earthlings. Why don't you expand a little bit about that?
Sure. The whole Martian is a case study, but the generalized proposition is this, that we now have available research tools, kind of as searchlights into the universe, that have recently become available that we haven't had them before. One of these research tools is remote viewing, which was coincidentally was developed at SRI while I was there by Dr. Hal Puthoff and Russ Targ, who I initially met there and were fellow colleagues of mine there. For those who may not be familiar with it, if we take the time-space continuum, you can locate any point in space in the time-space continuum and go to any other point in time-space continuum and gather information there and bring it back to the other. Well, the remote viewing protocol is a very rigorous scientific protocol, which is replicable. That's the basis of the scientific experimental methodology, where you can replicate results time after time. And that's what you can do under remote viewing. And the one way remote viewing developed in the 1970s, which they used principally for military intelligence applications, the remote viewer using this methodology would one way go to a designated point in time space and remote view what was that the information there, and bring that information back and report on it, and could do that verifiably over and over and over. The evolution that took place in the 1990s, which is really an advance for the exopolitical field, is the development of scientific remote viewing. And what occurs there is the same basic remote viewing tasks, but we use the in scientific remote viewing, the consciousness of the remote viewer in what they call subspace, which is kind of outside of an individual time-space context, achieves interactive communication with the consciousness of an entity in an off-planet culture, or a representative in a universe governance body, and can derive a lot of information about that culture, how it operates, can derive a lot of information about that governance body, how it operates, and what its strategic plans are, and how it would like Earth, you know, what its recommendations are. And this is can be done again on a referral basis. You can go back over and over and over and get this with different remote viewers. So you begin to get a degree of accuracy. Of course, it hasn't been verified by actual physical contact, but these are kind of searchlight tools that you can do to begin to develop public policy, a public diplomatic, public interest diplomatic outreach to different off-planet cultures where contact has been authorized. And one of the case studies, which is subject again to verification, and there may be others, is that through scientific remote viewing, it has been preliminarily established, and this has been replicated, that there may be an intelligent civilization on Mars, which is the civilization that was existing at the time of the great cataclysm, a great ecological cataclysm that planet Mars suffered, which blew away its atmosphere, blew away its surface. It may have affected other parts of the solar system, but at least with regard to Mars, that's why Mars appears to be the denuded planet that it is now, and yet it has so many Earth-like features. At one time, it was very much Earth-like. What the scientific remote viewing data also suggests, again as a case study, is that there's an advanced group called the Advanced Grays, which are about a million years ahead of Earth in evolution, who serve as almost the Galactic Red Cross, who were deployed to rescue the Martians. And what the Advanced Grays can do, they have the ability, you remember from science fiction of time travel. Well, advanced space travel turns out to be advanced time travel, because you're going vast distances, as many light years, you want to get there instantly. So what the Advanced Grays were able to do with the authorization of galactic authorities was to rescue the Martian civilization at that time, to bring them forward in time to the present day, and so that we have a present-day civilization on Mars that were brought forward in time, a couple of million years or whatever, and they're about 150 years in advance of Earth technologically. And what the remote viewing transcripts say, and this is that from the galactic standpoint, it would be ideal to have cross-fertilization and cross-immigration at this time between the Martian civilization that is slightly more advanced than ours and lives underground, is not warring. They're at peace with themselves. They don't have civil wars. Their prime kind of defense mechanism is secrecy. And the terrestrial, the Martians would like to emigrate to Earth because it's a very harsh environment there to live underground. And the Martians have established some bases in South America. We're from the same genetic pool, according to these transcripts, and they sort of look like Andean Indians. And many of the flying saucers that you see may be Martian ships. So according to this scenario, if we had the initiation of diplomatic relations between the Martian civilization, I'm saying this is a case study of what we call the Star Dreams Initiative instead of the Star Wars Initiative, we could initiate and verify whether this is true using scientific remote viewing. We could follow it up with a lot of verification now that we have the rovers on Mars, and begin to establish, probably initially through subspace, through remote viewing, a whole context and a whole legal framework here. And we would benefit by the immigration of Mars. It certainly would result in an outburst of humanitarian impulse among humanity, probably get us out of our autistic, you know, fixation on permanent warfare. We have 150 wars at any one time on the planet. At the same time, they have perfected free energy devices that they can sort of help us with. They've been living underground for a long time and in kind of that era, and we're just about to be hit with a lot of potential environmental cataclysms, so they could help us in terms of that. So from the galactic point of view, that's why they've authorized this planetary relations, because it looks like a good way, that there's a lot of good way for fertilization. That's a case study, hypothetical, subject to verification, of a good first start, maybe, for the Star Dreams Initiative, an example of what we could do in this open 10-year period of the Decade of Contact, which would be publicly funded, and which would unleash an unprecedented period of human creativity, expansion of you know, positive technology, sustainable development, economic activity, prosperity, etc.
All right. You indicated in your speech earlier today you thought the UN, a lot of the attacks on the UN are as a result of their friendliness to the ET phenomenon, the thing they passed in the late 70s. Do you recall what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I think that the objective evidence would demonstrate the fact that the United Nations, being a legitimate international body, that in 1978 passed a United Nations General Assembly resolution calling upon all member nations to outreach and conduct research and other substantive programs with regard to extraterrestrial life, thereby not only acknowledging the reality of extraterrestrial life, but calling upon members to take positive programs, and also authorizing the establishment of an actual office within the United Nations for extraterrestrial life. And we know from the scientific remote viewing transcripts of the Martians is that from their end, they did not want to negotiate with any particular one nation. They want to negotiate with the closest thing that we have to a representative of the world, and that would be the United Nations under the authority of the United Nations General Assembly resolution. The sponsor, one just has to look at the brutal physical political facts. The sponsoring nation of that resolution, Grenada, in 1978, several years later, was brutally invaded by the United States in a military invasion. And both Sir Eric Gary and Jimmy Carter, Sir Eric Gary was Prime Minister of Grenada, and Jimmy Carter was President of the United States. They were both, they both had UFO encounters. So the UFOs had been working with them and had brought them to those positions, and Grenada was subsequently invaded by the United States. Secondarily, if we move fast forward to the current efforts, for example, you know, all the food for oil scandals and all of that, one can reframe them in terms of what we call political stings and kind of sting operations, you know. And in there, for example, in our capacity for cooperation in space, we now have before the United Nations General Assembly a space preservation treaty to permanently ban all weapons of warfare in space. And we've been working on that since 2001, when the Bush administration terminated, first threatened to terminate, and then in 2002, when it actually terminated the anti-ballistic missile treaty, thereby opening the way for the weaponization of space through the ballistic missile defense system and other space-based systems. And we had seven cities in Canada, one city in the United States, pass resolutions calling for a space preservation treaty conference. And we've been working with the Foreign Minister of Canada, which on March 14th called in a speech at the UN, said that Canada would lead and break away from the UNCD and call an independent space preservation treaty conference. Well, this is exactly coterminous with the oil, for example, the oil for food program, which is highly suspicious and bears many of the stigma of a kind of sting operations. And over the years, if you go back to the 1950s, the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, all of the anti-United Nations propaganda that has been generated by covert U.S. military intelligence operations, allegedly on, the U.N., this, the U.N., that, kind of demonizing it, in fact, is all based on the information war against extraterrestrials. Because the U.S. government knows, in the same way that we know from remote viewing, that the extraterrestrials say, well, it's the United Nations that we would be recognizing. The U.N. says, well, here's a General Assembly resolution that says, yeah, we're the guys to contact. So therefore, the U.S. has got to engage in this enormous demonizing and information war against the U.N., including and up to and including the George W. Bush, who's trying to send in their guided missiles like Richard Bolton to destroy the U.N. It's as clear as day. It's totally transparent. And the American public and the world public should see through it once and for all.
All right. Now, should Hillary Clinton become president, do you think she'll be thwarted like Jimmy Carter was? Is it going to be, she going to have to fight it out to try and get an exopolitical agenda through? And is she going to be able to get more answers for us regarding the ET phenomenon?
That's a key question. And I would like to approach that in a spirit of the glass half full rather than the glass half empty. Because we're 30 years down the road from where we were at the time of Jimmy Carter, and we're under a period. It looks, we may be under increasing global environmental stress of great magnitude, where an interactive exopolitical agenda is truly kind of the only way through the eye of the needle for planet Earth to not end up either in the Armageddon scenario, the Earth ends by fire, or in the global warming scenario, the Earth ends by ice. From my understanding and from the documents that I've read, Hillary Clinton has a heroic role, behind-the-scenes role, and personal interest in these areas. She has a sound grasp of public policy. And she's met in the early 1990s with people, with the whole groups there, people like Lawrence Rockefeller, who are promoting this issue. And not only that, my understanding is that in recent years, she has come to the aid to protect through at NASA to protect the integrity of photographic evidence, perhaps suggesting exoarchaeology, that evidencing artificial structures and other prior evidence of other prior intelligent civilization presence within the solar system, and that's a matter of public policy and of exopolitical public policy. So I don't think that it's wise to even project that what happened to Carter would necessarily happen to a President Hillary Clinton. I think that we're in far different times, and the weight of public opinion would be with her, and that even the military intelligence agencies, which may have been united against Carter, would be not that united now. And certainly what we had deployed against Carter was a very, very destructive person in the form of former President George Herbert Walker Bush. And he's not going to be around now in this new scenario in as destructive a way, one would hope. He's been one of the meanest anti-exopolitical agents of the last 60 years. I think that he would be in a much senior position and hopefully out of the picture. So I think she'll have better sailing with Bush out of the way.
Now, as a futurist, you're talking about the galactic super wave. What can you give some idea of what that's all about, and what do you think what it is, and what you think is going to be the result of it? What we'll experience as a result of this galactic super wave?
Well, I think there's more information as to the first part of it, that is what it is, as to what we're going to experience. Because it's very uncertain what the magnitude of it is and what the effects of it may be, or even what the time sequence may be. But in brief, and people who are more interested in this, I would commend to them the works of Dr. Paul LaViolette, which again we posted up at exopolitics.com. There's an article there, has the 2012 galactic superwave, is the 2012 galactic superwave here? And it's a complete article that just goes in depth, lists all the articles, links to them, kind of a primer. So that in summary, if we look at our galaxy, our galaxy is a very unstable entity. It's kind of like this very unstable volcano in the middle of the universe. And if you look at the galactic center, which the Mayans call Unankub, it's like the center of a volcano. And periodically, the galaxy will actually erupt or have these eruptions. And apparently there's a periodicity to it. And I would commend you to go to websites like Dr. LaViolette's to chart all of these to get really into the intricacy of it, of the one, you know, of 12,500 BC and all. I mean, to really just mark them with all the extinctions, maybe coterminous with the end of a civilization that may have existed 12,500 years ago, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the hallmarks of these volcanic eruptions of the galaxy is that they occur, one of the cycles is every 13 to 26,000 years. Well, the 26,000 year cycle comes up in 7 years, with the apex kind of being on December 21st, 2012, the famous date at which one organic unit of time of the Mayan calendar, they call it tums, ends and another begins. Supposedly, the good news is that in the Mayan sequence, it's the beginning of the Golden Age. And these are characterized by Earth changes in the Mayan phase, by Earth changes and evolution of consciousness. And physically, they're characterized by several things. One is that the explosion of neutron stars, which emit gamma ray emissions. And one such neutron star explosion occurred in Sagittarius about 45 million light years ago. And according to NASA, which held a press conference in mid-February, the gamma ray outburst reached Earth on December 27, 2004, just at the time of the December 26, 2004 tsunami. So that the most plausible explanation for the tsunami may have been this neutron star explosion, however, accompanied by a galactic superwave. So that the tsunami may have been caused by a galactic superwave, the beginnings of a galactic superwave. And so that wave now is beginning to come through us, and we're now beginning to experience increased, you know, energy flowing through Gaia, through the whole biosphere, affecting all of the Earth. You know, it brings increased pressure at this higher level of energy. All the tectonic plates adjust. The sun adjusts. It may affect the sun to produce solar flares that may affect us. It may affect all biological systems, the entire biosphere, us as individual humans. You know, you have humans going off and doing crazy things, engaging in wars, doing all kinds of things, being very worried, having kind of, you know, freak outs and energy things. And so this is a time to be very connected to the inner self, because this kind of galactic energy is coming through the planet, because it's an aid in the evolution of consciousness. That's sort of the galactic picture. It may be that the whole UFO phenomenon, which started 60 years ago, was like a signal, a communication coming out from universal side. Hey, guess what? Get ready, the galactic superwave is coming.
All right, well, we should probably wrap it up because I've taken up a lot of your time here. So you mentioned your book and your website, and I want to definitely thank you for sitting down with me and talking to me and spreading the word to the people who come to my website.
Yeah, totally, Tim. What it is that we've just released through Universe Books kind of the basic book that defined the field of exopolitics. It's called Exopolitics, Politics, Government, and Law in the Universe. And you can get it very easily. Just go to exopolitics.com and just you can just go to the shopping cart there. It'll be shipped to you. It'll arrive in a couple of 3 days.
So there you have it. That's Alfred Weber, the father of exopolitics. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Next week, we hope to have the Monsignor Corrado Balducci interview. But if that's not worked out, we will be rolling out the first in a series from the X-Conference press conference held at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on the Monday following X-Conference. I was there. I got it all. And we're going to be rolling it out in installments. I believe they're about 40 minutes each. And I think there's about 3.5 of those installments, so we'll be rolling those out over the course of June. Thanks for stopping by, beenallofamerica.com, and have a pleasant day.